Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
A Thomistic approach to the good life. What I'm going to do in this first talk is to try to introduce in just an hour a Thomistic approach to the good life. And when I was preparing for this, I started thinking about what seemed to me to be some core features of Aquinas's ethics, core features that characterize it, some of its fundamental principles. So these are my reflections as part of a conversation with you over the coming days. But going forward, there are plenty of other resources to explore the Thomistic account of the good life further, and we can discuss some of those in the concluding session, perhaps. So just as there are for Aquinas seven key virtues, the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, and the four cardinal virtues of prudence, temperance, justice, and courage, and seven capital vices, pride, envy, wrath, sloth, avarice, gluttony, and lust. So in structuring my talk, I've come up with seven reflections and even seven key words to describe, to provide reflections about this Thomistic approach to the good life. So I'm suggesting that Aquinas's ethics is central. It's central to his thought as a whole. I'm going to talk about it being teleological, goal-driven. I'm going to reflect on it also being deontological, law-based. I'm going to emphasize that it's anthropological. It relates to our nature as particular kinds of animals, as human beings, and that it's good focus, that it releases true human freedom. I'm going to say that Aquinas' ethics is realistic. It accounts for the reality of sin, ignorance, and evil. I'm going to say, relatedly, that it's commonsensical. So in the sense that it relates to just what our core emotions and desires, we can relate to it. And seventh, I'm going to suggest that his account of the good life is empowering. It fosters personal transformation through the cultivation of virtue. And I'm going to, in the sort of final section of my talk, dwell a little bit more on that final aspect, the practical pursuit of goodness through the cultivation of moral virtue. Okay, so that's the structure. So, central. The first thing to say is that ethics is central. It's at the heart of Aquinas's thought. One might even justifiably call his great work of systematic theology, the Summa Theologiae, a work of ethics or moral theology. So how so? Well, in the 13th century, one typically finds, on the one hand, systematic treatises of theology, such as commentaries on Lombard's Sentences, and on the other, another tradition, treatises on the virtues and the vices, such as, most importantly for Aquinas' Dominican, William Paradis's treatise on the vices and the virtues. And what's striking, also in the light of a conversation I had earlier today, is that Aquinas treats theology, systematic theology, in pretty much the same order. So God and creation in the first part, Christ and the sacraments in the third part, as that standard theological textbook of his time, the Sentences of Peter Lombard. So the Sentences has book one on God, book two on creation, book three on Christology, and book four on the sacraments. It is not then Aquinas who puts Christ last in his systematics, as some of his Protestant and indeed Catholic detractors have claimed, or at least that is not his innovation, but rather was the standard ordering of systematic theology in the schools, universities, and the university textbooks of his day. Instead, Dante's innovation, is to insert in the middle of his systematic theology a huge treatise on ethics, incorporating thereby a revised version of the other medieval genre, the treatise on the vices and the virtues. So as any of you who have sort of looked into the Summa Theologiae at all know that middle part on ethics is much, much longer. It comprises 303 questions than the other two combined. So the other two combined comprise only 209 questions. So ethics is central to Aquinas. And why is that so? Why does Aquinas place ethics at the heart, the centre of his Summa of Theology? And this leads us, I think, to the second key thing about Aquinas' ethics, namely that it's teleological, from the Greek telos, meaning end or goal. It's purpose-driven, it's goal-oriented. We see in the structure of the Summa a great moral dynamism, the so-called exitus and reditus of man coming from God and returning to him. So the first part is about God. And Aquinas considers everything else, the whole of creation, in relation to God. The second part is man who came from God and who desires to return to him. And the third part is God made man, Immanuel, God with us. So God made man, God becoming man, in order to lead us back to God. So the first part is about God, everything in relation to him. The second part is about man. And the third part is about God made man, God with us, in order to lead us back to God, the exitus and reditus. Aquinas' ethics is then teleological, goal-oriented. The starting point of the first part of the second part, the prima secunda, are questions about man's purpose. Things like, do we act for an end? Why is it that people desire different goals in life? What is the true end we all ultimately desire? And in doing so, Aquinas draws on the approach of Aristotle in the Ethics, for which he wrote an extensive philosophical commentary. And in the second part of the Summa, Aquinas reworks this ethical theory, but the emphasis remains Hellenic, dynamic, teleological. It is about inner dynamism towards fulfillment and completion. So you say, think on your end, consider your exalted destiny, consider what you're made for, and head towards it. Thus, Aristotle's Ethics famously begins, every sort of expert knowledge and every inquiry and similarly every action and undertaking seems to seek some good. So as Father John Mark was saying yesterday as well, you know, you've all come to this course for some purpose. You go on a TI retreat to learn more about your faith, perhaps, or to meet people or to have good food or something. But there's a reason for what you're doing. And Aristotle goes on to say, because of this fact that every action seems to seek some good, people are right to affirm that the good is that which all things seek. The good is that which all things seek. But what is this good which we all seek? And again, we see in practice, I was struck by this walking through Preston. And in the Preston Shopping Centre, that everyone's going around, busying around, but everyone's seeking different things in life. We see that everyone is seeking different things. People have got different goods that they're after. And so how do we discern what is the good that we all seek? And Aristotle goes on to distinguish between what he calls means, things which are useful, like wealth or food or medicine, and ends, like health or security. So we can say that wealth is very clearly a means because we desire money because we can get something else with it. It's a mean. And then health seems to be an end. But even some of those ends, like health, in fact, are not goods in themselves. They're means to further goods. So we might say health is not a good in itself because we desire to be healthy in order to do other things. Right, so that perspective was somewhat lost during the COVID pandemic, in the sense we kind of made health perhaps sort of started treating it as a final end. But it is an end. It is an end. But it's also we're healthy in order to do other things. So moral failure, then, we might say, is to treat an end or to treat as an end what is in fact a means. Okay, and I think it relates to what Father John Mark was also saying about idolatry, when a kind of lesser good, a good which is a mean, is treated as an end. So, what is the end that we can all agree that we are all seeking? And Aristotle, of course, famously says, well, happiness is that end. So we seek happiness not in order to attain something else. Rather, we seek other things such as health, security, money, friendship, because we think these things or a combination of them will make us happy. But, asks Aristotle, what constitutes human happiness? You see his sort of process of thought. What is human happiness? That's his great question, the great question of Aristotle and Pagan's ethics. But it's also the key question in the Christian tradition as well. Jesus' first words in the Gospel of St. John, addressed to St. Andrew, St. Andrew's the greatest saint in some ways, brother of St. Peter, St. Andrew, the first called, like St. Andrew. Jesus' first words in the Gospel of St. John are to St. Andrew, and he says, what are you seeking? What are you seeking? What are you after? And for St. Augustine, this is the ultimate question that St. Paul was posing when he preached at Athens to the philosophers, to the Gentiles. He says, the whole question is, St. Augustine writes, what makes a man happy? Tota igitur questio est, quid faciat homo felix. And one of the ways in which Aquinas' ethics is important, I think, is that it can be in conversation with other more moral theories, including classical theories, around that question. What is it that makes a person happy? So Aquinas' ethics is about responding to this question. It's about individual happiness, flourishing, fulfillment. And he believes, in a nutshell, that our true happiness lies in friendship with God, both here in this life and most fully in the next. To love God with all one's heart and to love one's neighbour as oneself. So we see there the wisdom of the Penny Catechism. Who made me? God made me. Why did God make me? God made me to know him, love him and serve him in this life and to be happy with him forever in the next. It's very simple, but in a sense that just encapsulates this understanding that our happiness resides in friendship with God, both here in this life and most fully in the next. So why is this important? Because this account of the good is showing that Christianity is not all about rules or duties. It's not about curbing our desires in order to function in society, as caricatured famously by Freud in his book, Civilization and Its Discontents. So if Christianity is just a sort of form of constraint on individual freedom. Rather, Christianity is, from this Thomistic perspective, a true adventure of desire. We should not be afraid of our desires, because our deepest desires, and Father Matthew was speaking about this as well in his homily, our deepest desires are what lead us ultimately to God. As Augustine famously said, my heart is restless until it rests in you. Or St. Ignatius reading the lives of the saints and discovering that that was where his adventurous spirit and desires could find fulfillment. Or St. Thomas Aquinas himself receiving a vision of Christ speaking from the cross, what do you desire? And replying, nothing but you, Lord. The whole enterprise of theology, and this takes us back to ethics being central and teleological, the purpose of reading the Summa is to grow in friendship with God. Thomist ethics is about making us happy, about fulfilling our deepest desires. It's about joy. It's about joy. But here we come to my third point about Aquinas' ethics. It is also objective. It's also law-based. It's also deontological. So there can be a tendency, less so now, but maybe 30 years ago, 20 years ago, in the academy, to distinguish Thomistic ethics as teleological from, say, Kantian ethics as deontological. But it's all important to recognize that Aquinas' ethics is equally law-based. Indeed, although the first part of the second part, the Prima Secunda, begins with a treatise on happiness on man's end, it closes with two treatises, one on the natural law, questions 90 to 108, and one on grace, questions 109 to 114. So Thomistic ethics is deontological insofar as it's concerned with what is right according to our distinctive human nature or humankind. It does provide an objective criterion for ethics founded on anthropology, on what it is to be a human being. In the Summa, indeed, before Aquinas discusses ethics in the second part, he first writes a treatise on anthropology, questions 75 to 102 of the first part, an understanding of human beings as part of the created order. And as I said, the first part's about God and all things in relation to him. So this is about human beings as part of the created order. And he states, we cannot master the science of morals unless we know the powers, the capacities of the soul. We cannot fully understand what we are to do, what our purpose is, and how we are to get there, which is the role of ethics, until we understand precisely what we are, what our nature is as a human being. Ethics and anthropology in this way go hand in hand. And in addition to writing a substantial commentary on Aristotle's ethics, Aquinas also wrote a very major commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, on the soul, which provides the philosophical groundwork for his account of the human soul in the first part of the Summa. So if in speaking of ethics, the emphasis is teleological, Hellenic, dynamic, our inner dynamism towards completion, in speaking of anthropology, we might say that Aquinas' emphasis is more typological, Roman, static. We're considering man qua man, his nature, his grade in a hierarchy of being, his particular capacities. And in the Summa, Aquinas underlines the harmony between this philosophical account of human nature and the theological understanding of man as made in the image of God and thus oriented to God ad imaginem Dei. Aquinas addresses the question of human happiness then, in this respect, through the function argument. Essentially, we need to explore the purpose of man by coming to know ourselves. Ethics, in this sense, is the science of what a man ought to be by reason of what he is. Know thyself was, of course, the great Delphic maxim. What does it mean? Know thyself. Know your nature as a human being, and in doing so, seek after higher things. Or as Dante puts it, consider your nature. Consider your nature. Know your nature. You were not born to live like beasts, but to follow virtue and knowledge. There's this sense that if we really come to reflect on what we are, we'll come to understand what we truly desire and what we're made for, what we're made to become. So, to provide an analogy of the function argument, the purpose of a knife is to cut well. The purpose of a roof is to keep the rain off and withstand the elements. The purpose of the eye is to see. And so Aquinas will be saying, well, if that's the purpose, that's the characteristic function of those things, what's the characteristic function of being human? And what's the purpose for which it was made? And here quite quickly he's going to make a distinction between acts of a human being, which are involuntary. So we talk of acts of a human being things like our digestive processes, which are going on at the moment after lunch. We can think of acts of a human being like our instinctive responses to sensible stimuli, whether they be pleasure or fear. We talk about acts of a human being on the one hand, and then we can talk about human actions. And a human action would be something like reading a book, listening to a lecture, choosing to go for a walk, choosing an apple rather than a banana. So what's the difference there? Well, a human action in some way is involving our reason. They're voluntary. They're a knowing willing rather than involuntary, an unknowing willing. So I'm not going to go further into this because I've got 7 points to get through. But for now, it will suffice to note the philosophical definition then of man as a rational animal. That in a nutshell, to be human is to act in accordance with reason, whether exercising the moral or intellectual virtues. And the theological understanding of man as in the image of God, an image Aquinas finds precisely in man's intellectual capacities of knowing and willing or loving. This is the true likeness or special kind of similitude between man and God, that is, in the shared intellectual or spiritual capacities of knowing and willing. God knows and God wills. We know and we will in a much lesser and different way, but in that way we have a real similarity with God. We're made in the image of a God in a way that all other creatures only have a shared likeness. So an understanding of ethics from a Thomistic perspective, an understanding of happiness, must be orientated by the truth of what it is to be a human being. After all, we may have a mistaken or incomplete understanding of happiness, and in so doing, we may make for the wrong goals and seek for satisfaction in things which cannot, in fact, satisfy us. And in practice, we observe that many people try to find happiness in different things and fail to do so. And that happens to ourselves much of the time. And similarly, some of our desires require particular training and curbing precisely in order to make us truly happy. So when we talk about the natural law, we say it's natural precisely because it responds to our deepest natural desires, even when these are obscured to ourselves by sin. As Augustine puts it, an image Aquinas borrows, God's image in our souls is like the image of a king stamped on a coin. However, God's image, this divine image, has become almost invisible in our souls due to our history of sin, just as a coin can become rusted over time such that one can barely make out, even though it is there, the image of the king. Nonetheless, God knows us and our desires better than we know ourselves and provides the natural and revealed law and the church's magisterium as the upholder of the natural and the revealed law to guide us with its divine authority, even when we fail to see or understand what is right ourselves. Even when, in other words, temptations to sin can appear more instinctively natural to us in a state of sin and ignorance and confused by ideological prejudices or vicious habits, our true natural desires are, in fact, in harmony with God's eternal law. Anthropological. I've mentioned that one of the great innovations of Aquinas' Summa Theologiae is to bring together two genres, the systematic study of theology, God, creation, Christ, the sacraments, and the systematic study of ethics, the vices and the virtues. But in the second part of the second part of the Summa, Secunda Secundae, he makes a groundbreaking development within ethics itself. Namely, to treat the virtues and vices not separately, but together. He treats, that is, vice and sin in relation to virtue. He treats evil in relation to good. Thus, Aquinas treats the 7 capital vices anthropologically in terms of good objects that may be desired or avoided. So in a 2015 article I wrote for The Thomist, I analysed Aquinas' new anthropological rationale for the 7 vices as a distinctive advancement in moral theology and a marked improvement on the rationale of his Dominican confrere William Peraldus, which instead tries to fit the 7 vices into the Augustinian understanding of virtues ordered love and vices disordered love. But in brief, according to Aquinas' anthropological rationale, to take those 7 vices, the sin of pride, and you can see how he's taking sins and relating them to goods. So the sin of pride concerns goods of the soul of our higher capacities. What are those goods? They're the goods of excellences, the excellences of honor and glory. The sin of avarice is in relation to goods, all those goods consisting in external things. The sins of gluttony and lust in relation to goods here of the body, the preservation of the body and the species. By contrast, the sin of sloth, acedia, is an aversion to the true good, God, because in seeking God, the soul is impeded in its desire for physical tranquility or bodily pleasure. The sin of envy is an aversion to the good of another, insofar as it diminishes one's own excellence. And the sin of wrath or anger is a resistance to the good of justice, because it prevents the inordinate vengeance desired. It's very much in brief, but hopefully you just get a sense of how Aquinas is wanting to look at all the traditional sins, and these have sub-vices, in relation to goods, whether it's of the soul, whether it's of the appetites, whether it's goods existing in the external world, that in some way we're failing to pursue correctly. So everything is in relation to a good. And this is a crucial feature of Aquinas' approach to the good life. Even when we sin, we are always seeking what seems like a good to us. It's an apparent good. As Chesterton put it somewhat provocatively, even the young man knocking on the brothel door is searching for God. Although Aquinas writes a lot about evil and the vices, including a whole treatise on evil, De Malo, Aquinas wants us to understand evil as always a negation of, a falling away from some good, from existence. And he wants to focus our moral attention on the good we are seeking and see our vices as obstacles to the achievement of that good. So he's always encouraging us to see devils as fallen angels. Right? That all the devils were originally good and they've fallen away from it. And he's always encouraging us to see saints as converted sinners. It's in seeking the good then that we become free for Aquinas. Freedom is not just freedom from constraint. In other words, to do what we want. It requires orientation to the truth. It requires orientation to the truth. There's no point from this perspective in being free to walk if you're lost in a dark wood with no idea where to go. Freedom requires an orientation to the truth. And it is in the play of our freedom that we can also turn away from the true good and seek false goods or apparent goods. But from this Thomistic perspective, and this is one of the things I love about Thomas, freedom is not just, as sometimes Christian freedom is caricatured, a choice between good and evil. For most of the time, Christian freedom is about the choice between many goods. The joy of choosing an apple rather than a pear. That's an exercise of our freedom. The joy of choosing a pink lady rather than a Granny Smith. That's an exercise of a freedom. It's not to say one's good, one's bad. They're both goods, but we have freedom to be able to choose between them. And that's also the secret of individuality. We're talking about, you know, different people in the earlier session pursue different potentialities of a shared human nature. One person becomes an expert in Japanese, one becomes a ballet dancer, right? Becoming an expert in Japanese, becoming a ballet dancer, they're both really good things. So it's the secret of individuality, what goods we choose. So when we're morally good, this does not mean at all that there is only one good moral path to choose, whereas many other pathways to hell. Instead, as we come to live in harmony with God's law, we have the freedom to choose between many goods, and in this way follow our individual vocations in our loving and desiring. So many other flowers, many other saints, look at the diversity of the saints, what extraordinary lives they lived and how different they were from each other. Whereas in a sense, it's the boring path is hell. Because when you look at the sort of the fall into sin, evil, often it's very similar, it's very same, it's very depressing. Oh, come on, haven't you got over that? Don't you realize that doesn't satisfy you? It's depressing. Realistic. While Aquinas' ethics is certainly good-focused, it also takes into account and deals with at length the painful reality of, or realities of, sin and evil. This, again, is perhaps important to underline, given that the presentation of Aquinas' ethics in the Anglophone Academy, at least, tends, with some exceptions, to steer clear of questions of justice, law, and indeed of sin. So in introducing Aquinas' ethics today, many scholars and teachers, as I say, they classify his approach as teleological. They call it as part of virtue ethics. And famously, Alistair MacIntyre, for example, in his book Three Rival Versions of Moral Inquiry, will distinguish a Thomist's broadly Aristotelian approach, which he says this is teleological, this is goal-driven, from a deontological approach in Kant, or from genealogical approaches, which he associates in particular with Nietzsche, but also with any inquiry which seeks to deconstruct the moral claims of a tradition as masking the will to power. And this emphasis on Thomist ethics as virtue ethics is really good. It's popularized Aquinas' thinking for today, and there's much which is true about it. And we might even say it reflects a cultural shift, even within Catholic thought and culture, to move away from a moral context which was previously seen as penal or sin-based or even sin-obsessed, with particular sins allotted a complex system of just penances, to a moral context which stresses happiness and Christianity as the way to get there. We might even see that in a culture which places particular emphasis on the importance of freedom, law, in a general sense, can connote a restriction on that freedom. And again, it's not surprising then that apologists for Aquinas or for Catholic thought will want to sell Christianity as giving the greatest freedom, as true freedom. And again, that is a Christian moral claim. It's certainly better advertising. Christian becomes another competing object of desire in the spiritual marketplace. And as we've seen, there's a lot of truth in it, that Aquinas even frames the Summa, his Summa Theologiae, his whole account of ethics, within man's creation by God, his return to God. And he sees this return to God, the full vision and participation in the divine life, as man's happiness. But there is also the danger of major distortions in such classifications, the classification of Aquinas as a virtue ethics, when they omit discussion of justice and the law altogether. As Ralph McInerney remarked somewhat wryly, there's been so much talk of virtue ethics of late, and of that one might say what the metaphysics professor on Second City said of his topic, the universe, what else is there? Once one actually gets stuck into the content of Aquinas' virtue ethics, one actually reads through the Summa, we see that it has much to do with the virtues of justice and law, the longest section of the Secunda Secundae. And characteristic of Christianity then from its beginnings is that freedom and law, freedom and truth, happiness and virtue come together. They mutually support each other. And moreover, that sin and temptation are understood in moral theology as present realities that are ignored at our peril. Aquinas begins his treatise on law as follows. We have now to examine the exterior principles of human activity. The exterior principle inclining us to evil is the devil. How he tempts us has already been discussed in the first part. The exterior principle leading us to the good is God, who builds us up by law and supports us by grace. So for Aquinas, the devil tempts us to do evil, while God builds us up by law to do good. In other words, temptation is the tool of the devil, so we'd better be wary of it, while the law is the very instrument of God, so we'd better know and follow it. Anyone who loves me listens to my voice. So law is really important in Aquinas' ethics. Law is, we might say, the map of happiness. Or to use another of Aquinas' own analogies, law, the moral law, is the light without which we cannot see where we're going. We cannot walk in the dark. In short, the law teaches us what to do to attain happiness. As Aquinas puts it in the opening of his short sermons on charity, in order to save his soul, a man needs a threefold knowledge. He needs to know what to believe, he needs to know what to desire, and he needs to know what to do. The first he learns in the Creed, there he learns what to know. The second, what to desire, he learns in the Lord's Prayer. And the third, what to do, he learns in the law. If law is the map for the journey, the light in the darkness, the instructions of what to do, we nonetheless do not walk or act alone. We must always pray to God to accompany us and sometimes to carry us with grace. As I mentioned, the treatise on law is completed with the treatise on grace. We're getting there. We've got to number six, commonsensical. Common sense. It's quite difficult to provide an overview of a Thomistic account of the good life straight after lunch and in less than an hour. So I'm doing my best. Stick with me. I'm nearly there. And I'm going to cut this next section quite a bit. So I think one of the things which drew me to Aquinas's ethics, having been exposed to all sorts of different moral theories at universities, is what I mean when I say it's commonsensical, right? It just kind of makes sense in a very humble and basic and simple way. And I'm just going to give a couple of examples in terms of his account of the emotions. It makes sense, it seems to me, of just standard emotions, the most basic of which are our emotions of love. We all love things and we all hate things, what he calls concupiscible emotions. So, you know, Aquinas says, look, what do we love? We love things we perceive to be good. And what do we hate? We hate things we perceive to be evil. When that good is absent, when we don't have it, we feel a desire for it. When we have that good, when we're eating the chocolate cake, we feel joy and pleasure. But both when we're desiring the good but don't have it, and when we're enjoying the good, so the good is present, love remains. So love is there throughout that process. And similarly, if we look at evil, when there's an evil thing and it's absent, we don't have it, we feel aversion. We want to go away. We want to move away from evils. When it's present, when we're having to succumb to some kind of evil, we feel sadness, sorrow. But our hatred of the evil persists, both when we don't have it and we're averse to it, and when we have it and we're suffering under it. So there, immediately, you have an account of the basic emotions of love in its aspect of desire and joy, hate in its aspects of aversion and sadness. And these six basic emotions, love, desire, joy, hate, aversion, sorrow, he says, fall within the concupiscible appetite, and the virtue of temperance is concerned especially with the regulation and proper functioning of this appetite. And I'm just mentioning it like this because I feel when we talk about this, you know, you could kind of explain that to anyone. It kind of makes sense. The basis of his ethical theory makes sense. And if we go then to the irascible emotions coming from ira, anger, they're kind of higher up here, they're more complex emotions. Well, these are also dealing with goods and evils, but we're talking about goods which are difficult to attain. So it's not difficult for me to get a bar of chocolate. That's a simple good. But it would be difficult for me to train to become a doctor or a computer scientist. But that's still a good, but it's a difficult good. And similarly, there are some evils which are difficult to resist. And I won't give an example of that. So let's take an example there of this good which is difficult. So there are some goods then which we seem to love and hate at the same time. So you might say sometimes even studying philosophy, for me, certainly studying computer science would be like that. You know, that we'd love the good, we'd want to have the truth, but we hate the difficulty involved, right? It's really hard to study philosophy. It's really hard to study computer science. You're sacrificing something by being here, right? And not, I don't know, being out in the beautiful sunshine in England at the moment, but of course it's pouring with rain. But you might be sacrificing being out sunbathing to be here. It's difficult. It's a difficult good. And for those difficult goods, then we have a whole other set of emotions, right? We have the irascible emotion of hope where we have a desire, but it's a special kind of a desire for a good which is seen as possible. And we have despair where that good is seen as impossible to us. And if we possess the difficult good, it brings joy. And if we despair of the good, it brings sorrow. So, you know, I might try to take a course in computer science, which I realize is difficult. I may hope to be able to do it when this seems possible and even do it. And I'd get this higher satisfaction for having completed a course of computer science than, say, a sensual joy of just eating some chocolate. But conversely, I might try to do a course in computer science, then despair. when this seems impossible to me, and then feel a genuine sadness because it's meant that I failed in that course, but also that I haven't learned those skills. So I can't use them in my career. I can't have those skills. And he does the same with perceived evils. But really, I'm not going to go into all of that, and I can give you books to do it now. But I just want to give a flavor of the sense that I certainly had coming to Aquinas' ethics, that it kind of just makes sense of your ordinary emotions. Okay, it just kind of makes sense. It's commonsensical. So finally, then, empowering, 7. Aquinas' ethics are empowering. It's not just about obeying or disobeying rules, although rules are very important. But it's empowering because it's an approach to the good life which enables us to be transformed, to change over time. It tells us that we don't have to stay how we are. Right? If we're struggling with these things we don't know, it doesn't always have to be like that. We can get better through practice. We can learn to act in accordance with our reason. We can. Aquinas doesn't just direct us to a goal, happiness, but he sets out the virtues as a pathway towards it. So virtue then is a disposition of our character. It's concerned with some of those feelings I've been talking about, the passions. It's concerned with actions. It's concerned with choice. And acting virtuously involves a practical judgment. But also then, for us in the kind of messiness of living, you know, we're born in sin and ignorance. One of Aquinas' prayers, you know, we're born in sin and ignorance, a degree of trial and error. You know, as we try to find the golden mean in any situation, it's realistic again in that sense of our lives, you know. So again, just to give a brief sense of this, we have this theory of the golden mean. According to the moral theory, all passions and actions fall on varying scales of deficiency, of lack and excess, of too much. And virtue in each case is acting in accordance with reason. We talk about acting reasonably in a sense of reason, being able to reason in a given situation. So the example of courage or fortitude is concerned with feelings of fear on the one hand and confidence on the other. So one extreme, you might have complete terror in relation to that spider walking across the room, and at the other, foolhardy and rash confidence. To act courageously is to feel then an appropriate amount of fear. So in relation to a spider, unless it's a very big and poisonous spider, would not be very much fear, and respond with an appropriate amount of confidence and resilience to that situation. Courage, therefore, of a moral virtue involves deliberation. So an impulsive or passionate action will tend to be rash rather than courageous. So a charging bull, for example, it's not courageous. It's just acting from instinct. Another example, temperance is concerned with the pleasures arising from the sense of touch. So with regard to food, at the extreme of excess is superfluous eating, gluttony, and at the extreme of deficiency would be a form of undereating or anorexia. The virtue of temperance is being reasonable with regard to food, in eating an appropriate amount given one's constitution and level of activity. Crucially for Aquinas, and this is again part of his real innovation in moral theology and why his anthropological revolution, if you like, in ethics is so important. It is the rule of reason and not quantity per se, which dictates what that mean is, what reasonable is. And this can be different depending on a person's state of life. So we don't just say, right, this is the appropriate amount of food for every single person. Everyone gets exactly the same. You say, no, you have an appropriate diet for a heavyweight boxer. And that's going to be very different to the appropriate diet for a lightweight academic like me. Right? So I can't just say, well, he's like, no, but you haven't got to go doing heavyweight boxing. Crucially also, it allows Aquinas to move seamlessly between the natural, acquired, and supernatural infused virtues, which was always a problem in the previous ethical theories. Thus, through the acquired virtue of temperance, we might seek the mean in the pleasure of food and a properly balanced diet ordered to our physical health. That would just be temperance within the natural order. But the rule of the supernatural virtue of temperance may include fasting and foregoing pleasure for our spiritual health and eternal salvation. So it's not defined by the quantity, it's defined by the reason. Virtue is in this way agent-centered, an act which is courageous for a trained and experienced soldier, may well be rash for an untrained, ill-experienced layman. Morality involves a training in the virtues. Just as an athlete may train to run a marathon through a regime of exercise, or a musician must train to play difficult music well and in tune through practice, so a moral agent must learn through practice how to act well. And crucially, we principally learn to become virtuous, not by reading books on moral theory, or even by listening to lectures on the good life, but by performing virtuous actions. And again, just to give a very practical, commonsensical example, let's say you've got a child or a person who's very timid, who's naturally inclined towards cowardice. And this is one of those beautiful places where Thomistic ethical theory has been taken up by modern psychologists. So someone who's sort of naturally timid is going to feel in any situation too much fear. They're just going to be overwhelmed with fear, and they're going to also have too little confidence to act well. So you say, well, how does this person act courageously? You don't just say, right, this is what you need to do because everyone else does this in that situation. And you say, for you, you're really, really timid. So let's just find some controlled situation where you can show a little bit of courage. And also, let's say to you, because your tendency is to be timid, maybe you need to throw yourself out there a bit, right? You need to just try a little bit hard. So if you're in doubt, just go for it, right? And then the idea is that if they continually do that, they'll gradually become more courageous through the act of doing. They begin to develop the virtue of fortitude, the disposition for them to act courageously in a given situation. So this notion of moral development, which is essentially Aristotelian and natural, again harmonizes with the Christian practice of moral and spiritual conversion, and what we might talk about in terms of the Catholic sacrament of reconciliation and confession. So the spiritual virtues, along with the natural virtues, must be practiced. And it's indeed through their practice that the agent cooperates with grace in perfecting them. So just to give a kind of Christian example of this, we might say that a Christian may be, let's say you've got someone who's doing their best, but it really doesn't have struggles to be charitable, or say to charitable giving. And a person goes to the priest and they confess, it's like, I've just got this real struggle. I'm not charitable to others, but I do have this desire to be charitable. And the priest then gives as a penance actions such as visiting sick relatives or helping at a shelter. But he might propose that those actions are repeated often, so that a charitable disposition is developed. So there's a difference here then between, you know, a person giving £5 to charity 20 times over a sustained period of time, and someone just in a kind of moment of fervor giving £100, okay, to charity. In the first case, the person practices charitable giving over a continued period and may develop thereby a charitable disposition. In the second case, the one act, although the same amount, the same quantity, £100, is practiced only once and therefore may not build an effective disposition of charity. So virtue ethics is something easy to talk about. It's rather harder to put into practice. And the same is true of moral theology. In a sense, it could be easier to become an expert on virtue ethics than to become a virtuous person. And a paradox of ethics is that one can be very knowledgeable of it in theory and yet be an immoral person in practice. The path of true happiness, the path of the good life, the path of the virtues is not always an easy one, especially at first, as we struggle against the pull of sin and ignorance. And yet, as Christians, we have invaluable helps on this journey, not just a natural and divine law which informs our minds of the good, even when we are ignorant of it and have not developed prudence to judge properly on particulars, but especially grace, by which God moves our will towards the good, as well as the supernatural infused virtues which we receive with our baptism. However hard the journey, for Christians, this begins then with the theological virtues of knowing and trusting in God through the certainty of faith, and following his law, in hoping in God as the good we all desire, no matter the present difficulties or obstacles on our journey, and in loving God, in growing in friendship with him, both in this life and the next. And in a sense, the cardinal virtues are about developing our natural faculties to support this supernatural vocation. So in conclusion, In this talk, I've tried to give an overview in just under an hour of a Thomistic account of the good life by drawing out what I've seen as seven of its key features, that Aquinas' ethics is absolutely central to his thought as a whole, that it's teleological, it's goal-driven, that it's also law-based or deontological, that it's anthropological, it relates to our nature as human beings, our passions, our desires, our emotions. It's good-focused, that it releases an authentic human freedom, not just between choosing between good and evil, but a much deeper freedom to choose between the different goods and to follow and become who we're meant to be. That is also realistic, accounting for the reality of sin, ignorance, and evil. That it provides a common sense account of the emotion, and that it's empowering and fostering personal change and transformation through the cultivation of virtue. Finally, then, I've emphasized that this path of happiness, this pathway of the virtues, is not necessarily easy at all, and that at times it is indeed a true via crucis, a way of the cross, but that God promises those who ask his help and grace on their journey. And I'll finish there.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.